You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish size your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in African American Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm your host, James West, and joining me today is Dr. Eric Gardner to talk about his new book, Black Print Unbound, The Christian Recorder, African American Literature, and Periodical Culture. Eric's teaching and research interests focus on African American literature and culture and American literary history, and he is currently a professor of English at Saginaw Valley State University. His first monograph, Unexpected Places, Relocating 19th Century African American Literature, was released in 2009, and was awarded the Research Society for American Periodicals' prestigious book prize. His work can also be found in edited collections and journals such as American Literary History and Legacy, a journal of American women's writers. To find out more about his research, visit his personal website, blackprintculture.com. Black Print Unbound explores the development of the Christian recorder during and after the American Civil War. As the house organ of the African Methodist Episcopal Church, the recorder held a national reach among 19th century African American communities. Through recovering the paper's history, Black Print Unbound offers an important intervention into the study of African American literary history and American print cultures during the 19th century.
So I'd like to welcome Eric to the show now. How are you doing, Eric?
I'm good. Thank you so much for talking with me.
That's okay. We're happy to have you. So if you'd like to introduce yourself to our listeners and just say a little bit about your academic background and how you've come to this point to writing about the recorder.
Sure. Well, I've been doing archivally centered study of 19th century African American print culture for, I guess, more than two decades now. And that sort of broad emphasis was motivated by a couple of things. I did my doctoral work with Nina Baim, and so I was really sort of deeply enmeshed in the sense of recovering 19th century women's literature, and simultaneously really sort of watching the beginning of the flowering of some of the kinds of conversations that Henry Louis Gates and John Blasingame had, really sort of fascinating stories where they sort of sat down and said, well, if we really want to make African-American studies be able to fully enter the academy and enter classrooms, we need to have this slate of basic works, right, reference works. We need to have editions. We need to have bibliographies. And really saw some striking parallels between both of those types of recovery and recognized realizing that that was really work that I deeply wanted to do and was deeply interested in. I think flowing from that, a sort of growing recognition that, especially with 19th century African-American print culture, there was just so much that we did not know. John Ernest, who's one of those scholars who I want to be like when I grow up, writes about how after finishing his doctorate in American literature, he felt like he had to really sort of educate himself all over again, almost get a sort of second doctorate by reading and looking and listening to other folks, because we were not really getting the full story of what kinds of things were happening in African-American print and the 19th century. I really sort of immersed myself in sort of digging that up, sharing it with folks, talking about it with folks. And one of the, I think, recognitions that I came to maybe a decade ago, maybe a little bit longer, was that one of the stories that wasn't being told was of the amazing geographic diversity of 19th century African Americans, that there were black presences basically spread across the nation and certainly beyond the nation too, that we just weren't talking about. And that led to my first monograph, which is titled Unexpected Places, Relocating 19th Century African American Literature. And the goal of that book was really to sort of lay out through some kinds of case studies, a variety of different locations that were, at least, you know, within the standard disciplinary discussions, were totally unexpected. And so there's a chapter on African Americans in early 19th century St. Louis. There's a chapter on African Americans in California, a chapter on black folks in Indiana, and then a chapter on the Christian Recorder and the ways that the Recorder sort of had a national reach rather than being just a sort of local paper. And the struggle in writing that book was a really quite early recognition that each of those individual case studies deserved at least a book and maybe several books on their own. And so after Unexpected Places came out, I really took that call for next steps very seriously and sort of dug into thinking about what those chapters might grow into. Began to really be sort of deeply involved in thinking about African-American literature and print culture in the West. But as I was doing that work, and I'm still sort of doing that work, the material that I'd gathered on the Christian Recorder kept calling to me, especially the collections of subscription and acknowledgments. The Christian Recorder every week would run lists of those who had submitted requests to be subscribers, right, funds to be subscribers, that had names and that had places. And so this was a moment where we could really sort of think about not just who was writing for African American periodicals, but who was buying them, who was reading them. Those questions really just sort of took over a big chunk of my scholarly consciousness, and eventually led to an article that came out in American Literary History, toward serious drafting of the book that became Black Print Unbound. So that's really sort of how I got to the book. The funny thing is that it's a really large book. I think the word count is over 140,000 words, and I'm still convinced that there are all sorts of stories that need to be told about the periodical and all sorts of things that I still don't know. So I'm still continuing to dig in.
So you mentioned John Ernest and then, you know, people, Francis mm-hmm. Smith Foster is probably another person
who
would be
yeah.
an inspiration. I mean, are there texts that you definitely see either this book responding to or kind of expanding on from it, whether it's you mentioned Ernest or if it's Foster or somebody else?
Yeah. I really see it as in deep conversation, and in some ways, I hope a worthy extension of the work that Francis Foster and also scholars like Shanta Haywood have done in terms of thinking through the presence of faith practices as being central to African American print culture. Among the amazing number of really compellingly well-developed arguments that Francis Foster has made. It's that we've really, much to our detriment, ignored the presence of Afro-Protestantism in print culture generally. And so certainly in some ways I viewed Black Print Unbound as being an answer to that call. I think, too, in other kinds of ways, the book speaks to the kinds of work that scholars like Carla Peterson, Joycelyn Moody have done in terms of thinking about how a range of African-American folks, especially Black women, who are oftentimes sort of written out of the scholarly record, really recognized that there were possibilities in print participation for... I guess really engaging in the kinds of community dialogues, public presences that the broader white-dominated American culture just didn't allow. And so certainly speaking to those folks' works too. I'd also add, though, in some ways the book is very consciously designed as a response to the field that well, for a long time we called it book history, and now I think the term print culture studies is a bit more commonplace. But book history has been white, to be blunt, and it's been silent on a host of these kinds of issues. And book history has oftentimes also been just that, book history. And one of my running arguments all the way through Black Print Unbound and also in much of my other research is that we really need to think about the ways in which the bound book, as an artifact, seriously limited the number of folks that we think about in terms of print culture, right? Not everyone could get the bound book out. And not everyone wanted to get the bound book out for a variety of different kinds of reasons. And especially for African Americans, difficulties in finding opportunities among mainstream white publishers for books, but also a real recognition that sometimes books would not best serve their needs. We really need to turn to Black periodicals to think about the ways in which African American folks in the North and sometimes in the South and certainly in the West used print to engage in a whole host of dialogues. And so part of the book is also very consciously designed to sort of think about, we can't just call it book history anymore. And even when we widen it beyond the boundaries of the physical book, we really need to think about the various kinds of different folks who were engaged in thinking about and in using print to get a full sense of what 19th century print culture looked like.
So you made that case persuasively about the kind of neglect that periodicals, particularly Black periodicals in the 19th century, have suffered, and you kind of give the comparison that a lot of attention gets put on the slave narrative, and that you kind of link that to the notion of the book and the book as this kind of almost like the highest form of pedagogical transmission or kind of educational intent or something like that. So what factors have led to that neglect? Is it purely just kind of an intellectual neglect by scholars? Is it that sources are, as I'm sure you found yourself, very hard to find, are scattered often? What factors make it difficult for these kind of periodicals to be recovered?
Well, and I think some of it is also deeply tied to the mechanisms of anthologies, the ways in which literature courses and especially surveys of American literature, for example, or surveys of African American literature are taught. In some ways, it's really sort of I walk a fine line because I am so fascinated by so many slave narratives, and the two slave narratives that are taught most often, Frederick Douglass's first narrative, 1845 narrative, and Harriet Jacobs' Incidents of the Life of a Slave Girl that comes out finally in 1861. Every time I read those texts, they blow me away. They are amazing. And I think that's certainly why those texts and that genre, one of the sort of central sets of reasons why those texts in that genre have become such a mainstay of so many, especially college-level courses, and not just African-American literature, but in American literature. Douglas' narrative is a tour de force. I commonly have students come up to me and say, well, you know, he's not Emerson. He's as good as Emerson. In some ways, he's better than Emerson. He's different, and I'm so happy that I get to see that kind of range. So there are all sorts of things about those texts that make them sort of naturals to move into literature classrooms. By the same token, though, and I guess just sort of saying that word token aloud marks the way that so many literature classes have to be taught, right? If I have 15 weeks to teach a survey of American literature from the Puritans up to Reconstruction, perhaps, and I'm meeting with my students twice a week, an hour and a half a meeting, and I'm describing my own survey here right now, there are a limited number of texts that I can teach and a limited number of issues that I can raise. And so the sort of easy way out is to say, well, we've got these couple of spectacular texts. They are available widely in good editions. They're excerpted in great depth in existing anthologies. Maybe I should go for those, right? And I think that it's out of our undergraduate classrooms that graduate students gain introductions to the broader field. And I think that really sort of, and it's, you know, out of the available books that you can buy and have on your shelves or that you can put on your Kindle. Those are the texts, the ones that are available, are the ones that folks begin their, serious scholarship with. And so we really sort of, by limiting ourselves to those two texts, we've almost, sort of synecdochically made them markers for all of 19th century African American print culture. And wonderful as those texts are, that's just a massive problem because at first it's an oversimplification, right? There are all sorts of different African-American texts floating around during this period. But it's also an oversimplification in terms of subject matter, in terms of audience, in terms of sort of material questions like circulations, of, how these texts circulated, all sorts of ways that that narrowing of what African-American literature in the 19th century might be stop us from having a real sense of how Black folks engaged with print and how white folks engaged with Black print too. So all of those features add to what you've already alluded to, and that's that many of the texts that folks who are studying Black periodicals are beginning to look at now just simply aren't readily available, right? If I want to look at the Christian Recorder simply as an example, the number of physical issues, paper issues, that are extant is tiny. And in fact, there's really only one extensive paper run extant of the Christian Recorder from the period that the book covers, the area that the years of the Civil War and just after. Just one extensive paper run. And so I have to go to Philadelphia and visit Mother Bethel, African-American, African Methodist Episcopal Church that holds that run. I have to go there to see them if I want to see the paper. That paper run was microfilmed, and so there are a number of university libraries that have that microfilm, but you can't really teach a class with a microfilm, right? Mm-hmm. Not manageable in that sense. And the only way that I can access the Christian Recorder online is through a vendor who has a paywall up. And so if my university subscribes, or if an organization I belong to subscribes, I have access to their version of that content. But if I don't have access to the microfilm, or if I don't have access to that online vendor's version of the recorder, I'm essentially out of luck because these texts are not available in anthologies. There aren't print runs that cover them. Only a small number of the texts in the recorder have been republished in any format at all outside of the ones that we've discussed. And so simply the sort of first difficulty is for, I think, lots of folks, including lots of folks who are currently in the AME church and really, really interested in their own church history, they just can't get to those texts. So that obviously, I think, sort of limits not just scholarship, but limits limits the audience in some ways. Just sort of getting the text out to people becomes a centerpiece question, because I think most of us scholars writing about these subjects, before you read my work, I think Frances Foster would probably say this too. Before you read her work, and John Ernest would probably say this too. Before you read his work, we really wish that folks would be able to read those original texts, right? Those primary documents, because it's by reading them that we entered the conversations. And if you can't get to those primary texts, then there are all sorts of limitations on the ways in which you can think about some of the questions that we're beginning to ask. So that really is a sort of, in some ways, a sort of a secondary motivating factor in a lot of my scholarship, and certainly in Black Print Unbound. I want folks to go back and read The Recorder. It's fascinating. There are so many rich stories by so many different voices that are there that we just haven't heard at all before. And so certainly one of the goals in terms of thinking about the various voices that are, the various figures that are talked about in The Recorder, is to give readers some introductions, to point them to some authors and some texts that hopefully then they'll be able to go in and dig in and read and write all sorts of wonderful things about too.
So let's give our listeners a bit more of an introduction to the newspaper in question here, the Christian
Sure.
Recorder. If you want to lay out kind of just the years that you talk about or focus on in this book, and say a little bit more about the newspaper, how it develops, where it's based, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, the Christian Recorder actually is still published today. It is the longest running African-American newspaper in the country. And it is now, as it was at its founding, the denominational paper of the African Methodist Episcopal Church. The AME Church really thought, began thinking about printing and print involvement almost as soon as it was founded, relatively soon after Richard Allen became the first bishop of the AME Church. He also became the church's first book steward, and worked very diligently to move the church toward publishing a church discipline, right? So a guideline for practice and for church law, as well as a hymnal that could be used in a variety of different kinds of worship services. And the AME Church rumbled for several years and actually did make some attempts at starting up a periodical. The AME magazine ran in the 1840s. There were groups that were really sort of seriously thinking about the possibility of a weekly newspaper as early as the 1830s, although they did not make much progress until more than a decade later. And so the church was always really sort of deeply thinking about the ways in which it could use print to address what was really a growing national presence, right, that was divided significantly by space. So finally, the church was able, in the late 1840s, to appoint a new book steward who had some deep interest in the possibility of a newspaper, and that book steward was able to acquire a set of printing equipment. Interestingly, it was actually printing equipment that had been owned by Martin Delaney's newspaper, The Mystery, which is Martin Delaney's sort of early radical thinker in terms of black politics. Later on, went to write a wonderful novel called Blake, as well as a variety of other different kinds of texts. He left The Mystery, and as the paper was beginning to fold, they decided to sell off the equipment. The Recorder folks bought it and started publishing a newspaper called the Christian Herald. And the Herald was published relatively unevenly. We don't know much about it because there do not seem to be any copies extant. At least if there are extant copies of the Christian Herald, we haven't found them yet. But the Herald was published then on and off for a couple of years. And the intent was to make it a weekly paper. The General Conference of the AME Church, who was really sort of the supervising entity of all church functions, but especially this church publication, voted to change its name to the Christian Recorder, the sort of current name. And again, the idea was that it should be a weekly. Throughout the 1850s, it had continuing financial problems, difficulty getting subscribers and getting the subscribers that it had to pay their funds pay their funds expeditiously. And so it really stopped and started, and then eventually finally stopped almost completely as we moved through the 1850s. And then a fascinating set of events happened that really, I think, not only changed the face of the Recorder, but changed the sort of face of black print culture generally. And this is where Black Print Unbound really sort of picks up the story in earnest. Alicia Weaver, who was an AME minister who was at that point stationed in Indianapolis, had been working on a church magazine that is amazingly understudied, even though it's really rich, really exciting. It's called A Repository of Religion and Literature and of Science and Art. It was a quarterly AME magazine. And he had some real success with it. And so a variety of folks within the AME leadership thought, well, you know, maybe we can get Weaver to restart the Recorder. And they brought him to Philadelphia, reassigned him, and gave him as his charge the goal of setting up the Recorder as the AME organ, right? The way they envisioned that was that this would be a weekly newspaper that would connect members of the AME Church across the country. It would contain material that was tied to church policy and church practice, but it would also be a place where church members could share in thinking about national news, current events, as well as gain some sense of literature, of the arts, of the various kinds of things that AME members were involved in across the country. I guess it's really nothing short of amazing, but the amazing thing that Weaver did is that he was then able to start the paper and keep it running. And so starting with issues in January of 1861, he continued to publish with a few exceptions until he was eventually finally removed from the place in 1868. But that removal did not stop the paper. And as I say, it's continued to this day, still as a weekly. Under Weaver, the weekly paper was four pages. So one large sheet printed on both sides and then folded in half. After Weaver, the paper grew in size, changed shape a couple of times. But it's sort of basic goals that, you know, to sort of link the African Methodist Episcopal Church connection through print, those have stayed the same all the way through. And so Black Print Unbound focuses very heavily on Weaver's years in and out of the editorial chair between 1861 and 1868. First and foremost, because, as I say, that's really a sort of centerpiece moment in the Recorder. But, of course, it's also a fascinating moment in terms of broader American history and the ways print culture worked in that history, because as Weaver was starting the paper, the rumblings of the Civil War were already beginning, right? So a few months into publication, he's publishing a newspaper that really sort of a nation that is split by a conflict like it had never seen before. And the Recorder really in significant ways becomes a wartime newspaper. And so you get to see a range of war news there, lots of discussion about the kinds of things that the war might mean for African Americans and how that war might be practiced, what might happen after the war. And then Weaver, as I say, continues on until 1868. And so we really get to see some of the glimmers about how the paper changes once the Civil War is over, once emancipation becomes a national reality, and once the nation really sort of begins to think about what Reconstruction might look like. So it gives us a real window into the ways in which a sort of large national community of African Americans were talking about really some of the most important historical events of the 19th century. So the book really sort of thinks through those kinds of questions, and again, sort of does so in ways that look both at the paper as a material object, the business that was behind it, the way it circulated, the folks who read it, the people who advertised in it, but also really looks very consciously at the ways in which the kinds of texts that appeared, right, the ways in which the recorder thought about black print and black literature. And so Black Print Unbound also has then individual chapters that look at the idea of correspondence, right, the ways that folks wrote letters into the paper, chapter that looks at some of the poetry that was regularly published in the recorder all the way through, and a chapter that looks at a serialized novel that the recorder decided to publish in 1865 called The Cursive Cast by an African-American woman named Julia Collins. So the idea very much is to sort of think not only about the ways in which the paper circulated as a material object, but also the kinds of things that were built in there.
Let's talk about some of those chapters that you just mentioned.
Sure.
Starting with chapter 4, which focuses on subscriptions and subscribers. And you really, in this chapter, you really look to challenge kind of notions of who is reading kind of 19th century black periodicals and where these periodicals are being read. So, first of all, in terms of the diversity of the newspaper's audience, you kind of put a challenge to this idea of black print being predominantly the kind of realm of the elite or the kind of higher class of black Americans during the 19th century. So, how did you go about building? You've built this kind of incredible sample of subscribers. How did you go about doing that?
There's in some ways, I think, both the most mind-numbing and the most flat-out exciting work of writing Black Print Unbound, sort of both embodied in one moment. As I suggested a little while ago, the recorder each week published a column, oftentimes simply headed acknowledgments, sometimes headed subscriptions or some variation thereof. And the column listed off the names of the folks who had submitted funds with requests to subscribe to the paper. And paired with their names were the cities from which they were writing or the towns from which they were writing. And occasionally, sometimes more than occasionally, depending on sort of which year we're looking at, but at least occasionally, the minister who solicited the subscription or who helped move the subscription forward to the recorder, that minister's name is also sometimes listed as part of an acknowledgement of an individual person. And as I say, those lists were really one of the things that called to me throughout the project, because I think actually I would nudge even a little further than your question, right? We really have for a long, long time in studies of black print culture thought that, assumed that black print was the realm of a relatively small group of free African-American folks, mostly in the North, who had the resources and the time and the socio-political clout to participate in within that system, to print as a sort of piece of the elite. But alongside that argument, that assumption, we also, I think, for a long, long time, assumed that a number of the most, important or at least the best known texts in African American literature had largely white readerships, right? And so a lot of the scholarship that focuses on Douglass's 1845 narrative really sort of recognizes that this is a text that was published by the major anti-slavery organization in the states at that time, and that it was designed very consciously to be sold through their mail order distribution networks, but also to be sold as a souvenir at the lectures that Douglass and other abolitionists were giving across the country. And all of those venues, the great proportion, at least so the assumption goes, the great proportion of folks who would get the text in those ways were white folks. And as I began to look at the folks on those lists, And when I say look, I mean really sort of dig through census records, government documents, vital records, a host of different ways of sort of finding who those folks might have been. I was repeatedly struck by the fact that, first, they were almost all African American. And in fact, the sort of in the final totals of the sample, and the sample includes every, at least the sample that I began working from, every acknowledged name that was published in the Recorder between 1861 and 1868 that are in the extant issues. Overwhelmingly, the subscribers who I was able to trace were African American. So the number worked out to be, depending on how you're counting, between 98 and 99% of those located subscribers were African American. And then once you begin to sort of dig a little bit deeper into who they were, they were not always, and in fact, oftentimes, not members of the elite. They were working class folks, and they had an amazing geographic range. They had a real exciting range in terms of backgrounds, in terms of age. It's oftentimes quite commonplace that there would be what seemed to be sort of family subscriptions. And so the sense that a working class black family in central Illinois, right, might subscribe to the Christian Recorder for a year. That, for me, was really a sea change in the ways in which I thought about the ways that black print might be able to move around the nation. I mean, you want to talk about unexpected places. If you think about that, the title of my first book, here were all of these African-American working-class folks spread across the North and, in fact, moving relatively quickly into the South as soon as the Union troops allowed that, and the West, who were reading poetry by some of the best-known African-American poets of the time, as well as some really unknown African-American poets who are actually quite spectacular. And they were reading a serialized novel by a black woman writer. And they were reading accounts of black conventions. They were reading accounts of church policy. They were reading letters from Henry McNeil Turner, who would later become a bishop in the AME Church, but during the war years that we're talking about, was a chaplain for a Union regiment and was writing religiously in all senses of that word to the paper to talk about the kinds of things that black troops were doing. So to find that to find that sort of amazing group of folks, there was just a lot of basic good historians' work, right? So I went through every issue of the Recorder that I could get my hands on. I compared microfilm to online versions. Occasionally got to consult the physical paper versions, and I compiled a sort of massive list of names, noting the dates that they subscribed, noting the cities that the Recorder listed for them. When I could get a listing of a minister, including that material. And then for each of those names, and by the end we're talking more than 4,000, each of those names, I ran them through indices for the 1850 census, the 1860 census, the 1870 census, and the 1880 census, federal government documents that purport to record, to enumerate all of the folks in the United States at any given moment. And use those census records as then a springboard to looking at other kinds of vital records, to looking at city directories, to looking at a range of other kinds of texts. And so, painstakingly, person by person, looking for the name of the acknowledged subscriber and seeing if I could find information on them, basic demographic information that might tell us a little bit more about who they were. And it's a process, as I say, that took more hours than I care to think about, but also in really fascinating ways was quite joyous because so many of them, it was possible to find some details of their lives. And it was possible then to begin to build a picture of what folks reading black periodicals in the middle of the 19th century might look like. And it was a picture that wasn't at all like the one that we had been given. As I say, that sort of wide range in class, a real sort of deep similarity in terms of race, and really sort of other exciting pieces, a vast number of quite young readers or readers who had young children in their homes. Real significant presence by of African American women among the reader sample, and so to build this collection of records on individual people, and recognize that in addition to a whole bunch of fascinating individual stories, there was a larger collective story here that was not represented in the scholarship, became more and more exciting. And in the end, it also became much more difficult too, because recognizing that the sample of readers that I had and the information that they were telling me really sort of meant that I had to force myself to rethink how I was reading the paper's content. And so the close readings of various forms of texts that are in Black Print Unbound are deeply shaped by my sense of who was actually reading, who was actually subscribing. But it also demanded that I sort of take some steps back and think about how the paper made it to those folks, right? And so what kinds of church politics and local politics, national politics were involved, who the editors were at different points and what kinds of things they were doing, who the printers were, where their operations were housed, how they supported themselves, all of those kinds of questions, even sort of how did a subscriber in a given location get his or her copy of the recorder. So really, you know, with that large and very surprising sample of readers, I had to really sort of think about, okay, well, if these are the readers, then how did they get the paper, and what did they find there?
So you mentioned there kind of not just being able to kind of delve into the individual lives of these different readers, but also kind of seeing subsections of readership. And in chapter five, you focus on two particular ones, these soldiers or readers who are soldiers, and then women. Mm-hmm. And you kind of build not just obviously the dialogue that happens between the newspapers and readers, such as soldiers or women, but also the dialogue that happens between readers themselves. So how or why did you decide to focus on those two groups, and what kind of obstacles or challenges did they have in terms of both accessing the recorder and then in terms of this dialogue, this exchange in terms of reading and writing?
Oh, that's an exciting question. There was always, from the start of the project, from before the project, a set of questions that led me to think about the ways in which Black women might figure in here. I think in part, again, we could trace it to graduate training. We could trace it to a deep and abiding interest in the ways in which broader American culture has pushed women to the sidelines, very consciously trying to ignore women's concerns, to dismiss them out of hand, to keep them out of the public discourse, even though obviously they have so much to add, so much richness. A number of the texts that were being recovered as I was, coming up in the field, really sort of hinted at just the amazing possibilities in terms of Black women's literary texts of the period, and also a bit more quietly, albeit hinted at the importance of Black women as readers of Black print, as supporters of Black print throughout the 19th century. And so that group, I think, in some ways was always one that I knew that I wanted to explore. That said, as I began to sort of dig into the recorder, it became apparent that there was no way that you could study the paper without talking about African-American women as readers and as supporters of the periodical in crucial ways. It was really Black women who time and time again saved the paper from financial straits. It was Black women who time and time again helped Alicia Weaver do a whole host of tasks. We should, get on the table too immediately that Alicia Weaver's first wife, Mary, it looks like from the bits of extant suggestions that we have, oftentimes ran the paper, if not all of its content, ran the material operations of the paper when Weaver was absent. She's someone who appears nowhere in African-American literary history and yet is really a sort of critical figure. But there are a whole bunch of folks who, women folks who, like Mary Weaver, were essential to the paper. So I wanted to really sort of think about them. Of course, that does, as you've suggested, pose some obvious difficulties. One of the sort of central immediate ones is that the ways in which naming practices, especially 19th century naming practices, in terms of records of women, make searching difficult is probably, you know, sort of jumps to mind immediately. 19th century American culture, a woman is married, she takes her husband's last name. And so all records after that marriage bear her husband's last name, and very, very few of those records, so let's say census records, for example, no mention in the census record of what a maiden name might look like. And so no idea really of who that woman might have been prior to the marriage. And so there are a whole host of difficulties that are very specifically tied to that practice of having the husband's name foisted upon their identity, right, and changing the ways in which they appear in the records. I think there are a host of other kinds of questions, too, some of which are tied to the difficulties women faced, and especially black women faced, in terms of any kinds of public engagement. I can't begin to talk about the number of ways the dominant white culture tried to keep black women completely out of those public discussions, any public discussions at all. And so the women who were interacting with the recorder faced those things on a daily basis, whether it was walking to the post office where the postal official was going to be white, and was not going to be enthusiastic about circulating a black newspaper to anyone, and who was likely to be quite rude to a black woman, especially coming into that very, very white, very, very male, very, very public space. So a host of difficulties that they would have had simply participating there. I picked for the second group African-American soldiers in part because one of the sort of lessons that you learn relatively quickly in reading the recorder of the period is just how many black soldiers were writing letters to not only the Christian Recorder, but also to some of the other newspapers, black newspapers of the period, like the Weekly Anglo-African. These were folks who were really taking on what they saw as a twin duty to their nation and to their race, oftentimes at gigantic risk. If we think about something like the Fort Pillow Massacre, where black prisoners, Union black prisoners, are massacred by a Confederate general after they have surrendered, so killed under that white flag, right? They know the risk. And for most of the war, they're not even being paid at an equivalent rate to white troops. They're not receiving any of the kinds of resources that some white units are getting. And so they really are, you know, in all sorts of ways, making tremendous sacrifices for, based on oftentimes deeply held convictions. So they wanted to share their stories with folks. And the black press, especially the Christian Recorder, gave them a way to do that. And so the Recorder's pages are literally filled with letters from black soldiers, folks from across the country, writing about a real range of different kinds of experiences, and also, especially as the war continues, really making some definite cases, really actively participating in arguments about what the results of the war should be. Right? What should happen to black folks, and what should black folks be able to do after the Civil War is over? There's a stunning line in National Black Convention held in Syracuse in 1864. And there's a stunning line in the address that the convention agreed to have published. That goes something like, are we good enough only for bullets, or to use bullets, and not good enough to use ballots? And black soldiers writing to the recorder really wanted to emphasize that this kind of public service emphasized how much they deserved, right? The rights that were granted to any citizen of the United States. And so their writing, their presence of the recorder, and really their sort of much larger import in terms of American history and Civil War history were very, very striking. And so I wanted to get their voices in the book for those reasons too.
Certainly your use of correspondence is one of the most striking and in many ways original elements of the book. Unfortunately, we won't be able to kind of talk in detail about some of the particular people that you talk about, although if listeners are interested in looking up the text, Edmonia Highgate, and as a figure certainly that has an extraordinary story. How do you, like, what's your process of choosing? So obviously you have this sample, you have this array of each of these people could have an incredible story, and what's the process by which you decide, like, which people or which readers you include in the book, and maybe there were readers that you weren't able to focus on here that you left out that you really wanted to. So if you could say a little bit about that.
Yeah, there are, and maybe process is plural, because you know, certainly some of the selections, the selection of focused on African American women, the focus on African American soldiers in terms of thinking about folks who were reading and writing for the paper, you know, were guided by a whole host of questions tied to important issues in American history, American literature, and the kinds of arguments that the book wanted to make. And so certainly that guided some of the selection of texts, writers, subjects. But there were also moments where, to be honest, a given writer's work just had me sitting in my chair stunned. And I would go back then to that author's work, Edmonia Highgate, who you mentioned, an amazing black woman teacher who was deeply interested in American transcendentalism and wrote with a sort of transcendentalist ethos, gets talked about significantly in the book. I would go back to her work, and the question that I would have the second read and the third read and the fourth read was, is this really as good, as amazing as I thought it was the first time I read it? And repeatedly, right, I would come back and say, yeah, it really is. And so Highgate's story has to be in the book. Certainly, this was that sort of whole group of factors led to some of the focus in the chapter in Black Print Unbound that focuses on poetry broadly, but especially on the use of the elegy in the paper. And there's an amazing elegy that George Boyer Vachon wrote to his young daughter. And the poem is called In the Cars. And it's a poem that I mean, anytime you're mourning the loss of a child, that in and of itself is such an impossible task, right? It's an unresolvable grief when you know, you're thinking about the loss of a child. And Vachon's poem, In the Cars, does it with such thought and such beauty and such amazing power that every time I go back to the poem, I have to read the poem all the way through, and I have to have some, you know, sort of quiet just think time afterwards. It's just one of those poems that reaches out and grabs you and does not let go for a long, long time after you set the page down. And so, you know, did Vachon in some ways probably need to be in the book because he's an important African-American poet, because he's a real major figure in African-American activism and in terms of African-American education reform? Does he need to be in the book because he's really representative of a whole strain of African-American sort of longtime activists who participate in the Recorder's print culture. Does he need to be in there because he's a name that folks might recognize who were in who were doing, you know, thinking about Black studies in other ways? Yeah, for all of those reasons, Vachon probably would have come into the book at least in some fashion. But there is also just simply the raw power of that poem, the ways in which it continues to affect me to this day. That really sort of said, there's no way that you can write this book without talking about that poem, right? Just this, there's no way that you can write this book without talking about Edmonia Highgate's letters, because those are texts that we should all be reading, right? And not just sort of my testimony there, but when I teach those texts, my students' responses to them repeatedly are, you know, oh, this is an amazing text. And actually, some of my students then become quite angry because the immediate question becomes, well, why did we never hear of this before, right? Why was this not a text that we read in high school? Why was this not a text that we've seen in any of our anthologies? Why is this not something that we know? And so, you know, sort of thinking about some of those texts and authors that just reached out and shook me and that I thought would reach out to other folks in similar ways, shaped the decisions on some of the stories that that made it into the book.
And continuing that kind of theme of undiscovered or neglected texts, you finished the book talking about Julia Collins and The Curse of Caste. She's a kind of recently rediscovered novel, which was originally serialized in The Recorder, and it really helps to tie together a couple of the main themes which are going through the text, obviously one of them being the kind of recovery of African-American women writers in different forms, and then also this challenge or this attempt to complicate that idea of book history or print culture or the relationship between kind of periodical and book or bound and unbound forms of print. So just talking about this final chapter, first of all, how significant, how symbolic, how important is Collins, the serialization of Collins' work? And then also, how does, as an example, it speak to that kind of complication or that attempt to complicate ideas of 19th century print and print culture?
Well, I guess to think about the first piece there, and in all sorts of ways, Collins' novel is massively important to thinking about Black literature, thinking about American literature just generally, I think, too. There's, you know, sort of ongoing debate about what the first novel by an African American might be. Some folks argue that it's Hannah Craft's Bondwoman's Narrative, although that's a book that was never published until the 21st century, right? Appear, you know, we have that only in manuscript. Some folks argue that it might be Harriet Wilson's Our Nig, which is a spectacular book published in 1859 that has very, very heavy autobiographical tones and content in it. And some debate about whether it's an autobiographical novel or a novelized autobiography. Collins's text, though, it's clearly a novel. And it was published in the author's lifetime. It did not appear in book form until, again, the 21st century. But it did move its way through channels of editing into print that then was widely dispersed and widely read and commented upon. And so certainly, you know, again, if you sort of think about things that book on the Christian Recorder of this period, you have to talk about Curse of Caste simply because it is because of its firstness, because of its sort of marked place and sort of the development of African American print. But beyond those kinds of, you know, reasons that suggest you have to, again, that's one of those texts that I hope gets a much wider readership because it is really quite amazing in all sorts of ways. And I wanted to highlight a sort of set of those questions in the reading of the book. There's been a great deal of really good discussion on the ways in which the novel treats questions of gender and treats questions of a nation, and treats questions of Black education. But a lot of that work has focused on the protagonist, who, without giving too much away is not clearly associated with the free black community until relatively late in the novel. And I sort of wanted to step back and say, well, okay, so who is the free black person, or who are the free black people in Cursive Cast? The people that this largely African-American readership of the Christian Recorder might sort of immediately say, oh, yeah, there's a character who, in terms of demographics, right, has some similarities to my life. And the answer there was a character named Juno, who is the protagonist's caretaker, really sort of raises her, guides her as much as she possibly can, and then later in the novel becomes really quite crucial to the story, not only in terms of the care that she has for the protagonist, but also the kinds of information that she has gathered on some of the secrets that are shaping the protagonist's life, that are shaping the sort of key plot events in the novel. And so really sort of thinking about the novel through the lens of free African-American readers, free African-American characters, was, again, a story that I wanted to begin sort of thinking through, you know, the sense of what a black newspaper might do in terms of choosing black literature that it was going to then hand to black readers. So that sort of shaped the emphasis on that chapter, but also was really in lots of ways a reason that I wanted to make sure that Julie Collins, that the Cursive Cast were in the book. It's a rollickingly good novel, just first off. And it also sets out a whole set of fascinating questions beyond those that we've talked about so far, because Collins died before the serialization was completely published. We don't know if she actually finished the novel and the chapters just didn't appear in the paper, didn't get to the editors of the paper, or if she simply didn't finish it before she passed away. But so we've got an unfinished novel, all sorts of speculation on how the novel might have ended, including some real scholarly debate. That in some ways, I think, sort of emblematized a set of the questions that were really sort of crucial to thinking about the Christian Recorder and to thinking about black periodicals more generally, right? How do we access stories that we have only in fragments? Right? How do we deal with an archive that we know has been both consciously and unconsciously limited by a whole host of outside forces? How do we write scholarship about things that are incomplete, but that are still of massive value, that really we still need to talk about? And so in lots of ways, Cursive Cast became the sort of place where I thought the book should, I don't want to say end, because the book is still with me and I'm still sort of thinking about what the next chapters would be, right? But where the book would at least pause to sort of step back and reflect on what some of the key questions are in terms of thinking about the ways in which we access and approach black print culture in the 19th century.
It is an incredibly dense text, and unfortunately we're pretty much out of time for this interview, so there's so many other avenues that we could explore, individual kind of readers, individual writers. If listeners are kind of want to learn more about your work, where would be the best places that they could go?
I'm always busy, so lots of stuff in the works. I have a piece in the most recent issue of Legacy, which is one of my favorite journals, that is part of a forum that focuses on the sort of root question is where are the women in black print culture studies? So that would be a good primer in some ways. I have a website and a blog that folks can access at blackprintculture.com. That's one word, blackprintculture.com. And so I blog on some of these questions. There's a lot of stuff in the blog that are things that didn't quite make it into the book, but that were still fascinating. I'm involved in the early stages of what I think promises to be a really exciting project in terms of thinking about African-American literary history that Cambridge University Press is undertaking. It'll be a multi-volume literary history of African-American print. The sort of large series title will be African-American Literature in Transition. And Joycelyn Moody, who's another one of those scholars scholars who I want to be like when I grow up, a wonderful model in all sorts of ways. It's going to be the general editor, and I'll be editing the volume on Black literature and Reconstruction. So sort of thinking about new approaches to the ways in which we talk about African-American texts and questions that ran during that period. So look for that on the shelves, hopefully before too much longer.
That's great. It's been a pleasure to talk to you today.
Pleasure to talk to you too. Thank you so much.
That's okay. Goodbye.
You've been listening to New Books in African American Studies, part of the New Books Network. Support for the network is generously provided by Amherst College Press. For more information, go to newbooksnetwork.com, where you can subscribe via iTunes or follow on Facebook and Twitter. Goodbye.